looking around the room and I'm like, where's everybody else? What lessons did we learn? And it feels like Republicans didn't learn anything from the midterms. I mean, we buried our head in the sand. We didn't have a message. We didn't have a solution. And we weren't nice to women.
That's Congresswoman Nancy Mace, a Republican from South Carolina, who is pro-life, but blames her party's lackluster performance in the recent midterm elections on its extreme position on abortion. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
I don't take orders from anybody.
Nancy Mace is a fiscal conservative, the first woman to graduate from the Citadel, and one of the few House Republicans who can say they survived a Trump-backed primary challenge.
In the first congressional district, you have another horrendous rhino known as Crazy Nancy Mace.
I feel like I'm on an island. I'm literally a caucus of one.
With a standoff over the debt limit looming, Mace blames both parties for the fiscal mess the country is in, $31 trillion in debt and counting. She says now is the time to confront it.
I don't want to see the debt limit be weaponized, but we have to have an honest conversation and say that what we've been doing is wrong.
We discussed her positions that could put her at odds with her own party, including confronting climate change and decriminalizing marijuana.
Why would we deprive people from something that is not harmful? It is not a gateway drug. It is something that can save lives. It saved my life.
And why she has spoken out against controversial members of her conference, including Congressman George Santos.
I know we have a narrow majority, but is it really worth it to give this guy a pass?
Plus, I asked Mace, as a member of the House Oversight Committee, why Republicans seem more concerned about President Biden's handling of classified documents than Donald Trump's.
Whether you are at the top of the ticket president or a hardworking American, everybody should be treated the same under the law.
Then why is the Oversight Committee only investigating Biden? Representative Nancy Mace, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your journey has taken you from the Waffle House to the U.S. House of Representatives, where you now represent South Carolina's first congressional district. Mm-hmm. You were the first female to graduate from the Citadel. You're a single mom. You're a survivor of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. At the outset of your second term in Congress, how does your background and your own personal experiences inform the policy positions you take?
Well, my experience, especially my rough start, being raped at the age of 16, I dropped out of school at 17, and that's when my parents said, if you're gonna stop going to school, you have to start going to work. And I took a job as a waitress at a Waffle House on the side of the interstate. And I learned some very tough lessons during some very tough times in my life. And I learned about surviving, I learned about strength, I learned about having courage. Something that was very difficult for a teenager going through this trauma that I had. And I'd eventually get my high school diploma and would go to the Citadel. My father's a graduate of the Citadel. He served in the Army for 28 years. My mom's a retired school teacher. And, you know, I went there to learn about myself more than anything. I wasn't going there to be the first woman to graduate from there, but I wanted to prove to myself I could face an obstacle, face a challenge, face adversity, and I wouldn't quit. And that determination, not knowing, now I'm 45, right? I'm, you know, about to go into menopause. I've seen a lot now, but, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I look back at my life, and I just had no idea that this trauma, the challenges that I had, the adversity I faced at the Citadel, it made me who I am today. It made me tough as nails. It made me be able to face these challenges head on, no matter the headwinds. I've had so many, even in my first term in Congress, both sides, right, just coming at me because I represent a swing district, but it's giving me strength and it's given me and taught me courage, having the courage to speak up when it's just so important to the people that you represent. And there's nothing that beats the value of hard work. All those experiences, as tough as they were when I thought I would never make it, have made me who I am today. And I'm grateful to have overcome that adversity, to do what I'm doing today, because having an independent voice in Congress right now, at this time in our nation's history, is more important than ever.
You were the first woman to graduate from the Citadel, and you decided to apply as soon as they decided they would accept female applicants. You graduated magna cum laude from its Corps of Cadets in 1999, and even wrote a highly acclaimed book about your experience called In the Company of Men. What drove you?
It's that inherent need for me, given the trauma, and I didn't know it at the time, I think going into, I knew that there was something that I needed to do in my life by going to the Citadel. And that was facing a challenge unlike anything else, facing an obstacle that I would take that obstacle on and I wouldn't quit. Because when I was raped and I had that trauma, I wanted to end everything. I quit school. I wanted to end my life. And I got a job, I got things together, I did what I needed to do to get through that experience, as tough as it was, and it took a very long time. It's mental, it's physical, it's emotional healing, and that takes a lifetime. I'm still not recovered and fully healed from the experience, but it shapes who you are. And the Citadel for me was this opportunity to just say, F you, to everybody in the world. I was angry about what had happened to me, and I wanted to go there and prove to myself that no matter what anyone threw at me, that I could be successful. I could face that challenge head on, and I would not quit. And that is the lesson that I learned. And I learned, too, if I studied, I could graduate top of my class. I taught myself to code when I was in college. I didn't know that I had that side of me. But it taught me so much about life, taught me about survival, taught me about strength, and it taught me about having the courage to do what is right, no matter the consequences.
You've just referenced your rape when you were 16. Mm-hmm. And you talk about being pro-life, but yeah. You support exceptions for rape and incest, which is, frankly, outside the mainstream of the Republican Party right now.
It is now.
And, you know, you've been a vocal advocate for that policy nuance. How do you go about building consensus or support for that position in the conference?
Well, by being vocal. Right now, I feel like I'm on an island. I'm literally a caucus of one. In our first week of votes, we had multiple abortion votes. And I'm pro-life, okay? And I have a great pro-life voting record. But I also recognize that the environment has changed. This is not where the majority of Americans are. Neither side support the extremity of abortion up until birth. Well, that's just crazy. But just at the same way, advocating for a ban on all abortions with no exceptions, well, that's crazy too. And that's not where 80 to 90% of Americans are. And I represent a purple district, a swing district, and I have town halls almost every week that I'm home. I talk to my constituents, I poll on the issue, and right behind inflation during the midterm election, the number two issue was abortion. And I talked to Republican women, Democrat women, independent women. Independents in my district outnumber Republicans. And their voices aren't well represented in Congress right now either. But I've been willing to have this conversation and say, where's the middle ground? And these people that are advocating for no exceptions, what are you talking about? What are you going to say to the 10-year-old girl who's raped by her father or her uncle or someone else in her family? You know, and that's an extreme case, but those cases do happen. Or the young woman who has a fetus that is got so many abnormalities, if she were to carry it to term, it could harm her life or harm her ability to get pregnant again in the future. What do you say to that young woman? And so, you know, these are uncomfortable conversations, but I've been a loud voice. I write op-eds. I talk to constituents. I bring it up. And when we have these discussions, I often feel like I'm the only one in the room vocalizing what everybody else is feeling. Like, I'm literally saying what's on everyone's minds, but they're afraid to say it because they're afraid of getting primary. They're afraid of the base. But that's only a very small percentage, a handful of people, and a primary on either side. I don't understand it.
The other thing that strikes me is that you are the only Republican, as far as I can tell, mm-hmm. who's willing to point to the overturning of Roe and the question of abortion as the reason for the GOP having lackluster gains and barely cobbling back a majority in the House of Representatives this last cycle.
Yeah.
Why are you the only one?
I would love for you to answer that question for me, because I'm looking around the room and I'm like, where's everybody else? What lessons did we learn? And it feels like Republicans didn't learn anything from the midterms. And abortion Roe was one part of that. But the second part of that was we were nominating people that couldn't win general elections. And that's a problem, too. And not being able to read the room with what's going on with those who've left the Democrat Party, those who've left the Republican Party, that feel that they don't have a home because of the division that they're seeing today. And I make no mistake, I'm a conservative. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm a constitutional conservative. But I consistently reach across the aisle to deliver for my district in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, to deliver for my state, and to deliver for my nation. And so when my first term, I won by 1 point, right? I flipped a seat, I won by 1 point. This time we won by by double digits. We won by 14 points, flipping 40% of Democrat precincts, outperforming conservatives in the most conservative precincts that we have. And I think, you know, I know that it's because I've been vocal on these issues. I don't toe my party's line, especially when I disagree with them on spending or taxes or after Roe. I mean, we buried our head in the sand. We didn't have a message. We didn't have a solution. And we weren't nice to women, especially victims of rape and girls who are victims of incest. And I feel that. I feel what other women are feeling, and I want to fix it. I want to help. I want to find a solution. I'm willing to work with both sides.
Is this an issue that has just been, like so many other issues, hijacked by the special interests on both sides of the argument?
Yeah. And if you look at, you know, everyone wants to fight. Everyone's fighting, you know, for the extremes of both sides right now. But this issue is affecting women every single day. We have entire counties and rural areas in South Carolina, like many other states, that don't have a single OBGYN doctor. So when you're talking about, hey, we want to save lives, what about giving access to every woman in the country to birth control? Last summer, only 8 Republicans voted to protect women's access to birth control. And so when we're talking about these issues, this is common sense. And I'm grateful for my governor in South Carolina. He signed into law legislation that would allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control pills to women over the counter. That is a great first step. There's much more to go here. What are you going to do with the children who are born that don't have a home? The foster children, the orphans. I mean, what solution is, we're not even having this conversation. It's just about fighting the other side because we want to pay lip service to the pro-life movement. That's all you're doing. You're not actually doing anything to save real lives. And that's my problem with all of this. And I talked to Democrat women, talked to Republicans, I talked to independents, somewhere in the middle. Like, people are okay with gestational limits. Well, let's figure out what is that timeline. People are okay with exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother, even fetal abnormalities. So why can't we have that conversation? And I'm sitting here alone, ready to have it, but I'm the only one. It feels like I'm literally the only
Certainly
one.
Certainly the only one on the right. I mean, do you have any sense, you've been in Congress now, this is the beginning of your second term, do you have any sense of what it would actually take to make progress on this issue in a pragmatic way?
I'm going to be releasing a series of legislation and bills over the next coming week, starting this week and probably every week thereafter through February, it looks like, from a timing perspective. But looking at this, taking the positions I have and putting forth what that legislation might look like. And so those are things that we're working through the legislative process now, but I'll be unveiling bills. And I would encourage members of Congress from both sides of the aisle to get on board, because we're having these conversations and these debates and people are raising money off of it, but we're not doing anything for either side. We're not pushing the ball forward and doing that.
Do you have any conversations with Republican women who agree with you?
I have conversations with men and women in our conference about this. I mean, most people agree, but everyone's just sort of sitting on the sidelines.
And what about the flip side, the Democrats?
The same thing. I mean, everyone acknowledges that this is a problem. Everyone acknowledges there's somewhere we can meet in the middle. But again, where are the people raising their hand willing to work together? So I've sort of taken it upon myself and burdened myself. And it's not a burden, but I'm going to do this. And if you want to get on board, then great. But I want to show the American people, I want to show people in South Carolina and my home state, that this is how we can move forward. And if we don't do that, then we are completely misaligned with the people that we, by and large, that we represent.
And you're talking about forging some kind of policy consensus that represents the majority of American thinking.
Yeah, and it's going to cover everything from, you know, birth control to, you know, children that have been orphaned to, you know, we have a backlog of 100,000 rape kits in this country, across the country, that haven't been processed yet. I mean, they're just, so taking a pragmatic lens to this controversial issue to bring everybody together and put them in the same room on the same bill, I want to show what's possible. I want to show that how we can move forward protecting and balancing women's rights with the right to life. There's a way to do it.
Where do you think the middle ground actually is? Do you think, is it somewhere between 15 and 20 weeks?
I think it's somewhere between 15 and 20 weeks. It's ensuring that we have exceptions for rape and incest, life of the mother, fetal abnormalities It's birth control. Again, another, for some reason, why is this controversial with Republicans? I can't for the life of me understand. It's foster care. It's adoption. It's an amalgamation of legislation that shows that, hey, this makes a lot of sense, which is what we're going to bring to the table over the next couple of weeks.
You said you're also a fiscal conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the United States has reached its debt limit. And as Treasury Department has said, it's taking extraordinary measures to keep paying the country's bills. It's expected that, you know, this process will extend probably through the summer, perhaps even into the fall. And it is yet to be seen whether Republicans will be able to use this moment to extract some version of budgetary reforms, to instill some degree of fiscal discipline after years of not, frankly, having much fiscal discipline at all on both sides.
Decades.
Decades. Yes. You support using this moment as a leverage point to extract some budgetary, some spending reforms. And you have introduced in the House a version of Senator Rand Paul's six-penny plan. Explain how that works.
Yeah, well, the penny plan is one option. But first, before I go into the details of that, I want to reiterate that what you just said, we should put the blame of this on both parties, Republicans and Democrats alike. For decades have been increasing spending with no end in sight. And you have 49 of 50 states that balance their budget every fiscal year. And they don't have a printing press to keep printing money like the Federal Reserve. And even California has figured out they balance their budget. The only state that doesn't is the state of Vermont. And so when you look at, for, you know, years we've had record revenues, the spending's been out of control. It's been this administration, the previous administration, the one, two, and three before that. The last time we had a budget and balanced it was under President Bill Clinton. The last Republican to balance the budget was Richard Nixon in 1970. What is, clearly the process isn't working. And so utilizing this moment as an opportunity to say, hey, something's wrong here, and we both sides need to take responsibility, accountability, and put forth a plan. So the penny plan that Senator Rand Paul has filed in the Senate for a number of years, we've got the House version of it. When the penny plan was first created, you'd only have to cut a penny to balance the budget in about 5 years. Now we're up to six since the last year. I think it was five. Now we're up to six because we're at $31 trillion of debt. Now that's just to balance it in 5 years. Every year thereafter, the penny plan would allow for you to increase spending by double digits, by over 10% every year thereafter. We're going to file that bill again this session, but I'm even saying that do that now. I don't think you could do it realistically in 5 years. I mean, that's a significant amount of cuts. So what I'm saying, I'm going to file that bill, but also I'm open to, let's look at a 10-year plan. I mean, I think that's the only way that you can get both Republicans and Democrats on board is to have a responsible plan that would do it in 10 years.
So you're going to file the plan, but you're open to other possibilities.
Open to the conversation.
That might be even more achievable. Because there are some
more realistic, too.
Okay, you acknowledge that. Because there are some even conservative fiscal hawks who get concerned that, you know, the penny plan sounds great, but perhaps it makes it sound too easy.
Yeah.
For the fact that, frankly,
oh, it's not easy. Yeah.
Fixing the course of spending and the trajectory that we're on is actually enormously difficult, and there's just no way to do it quickly, painlessly.
Right. But it is possible. And if we don't have this conversation now and at least have a responsible plan in place, we are no better than the next guy or the guys before us. I mean, Republicans are just as much at fault as Democrats. I lay the blame with both parties. And, you know, families and businesses, they have to balance their checkbooks. I mean, the government literally shut businesses down during COVID. They had to make tough decisions to keep their employees and keep their doors open. And yet the federal government, 2.5 years later now, they still have employees that aren't showing up for work. So what are you talking about? I mean, clearly, you know, there's some room here to find those cuts, but it's not going to be easy because some tough decisions are going to have to be made. Nobody wants to touch Social Security. No one wants to touch Medicare or Medicaid. So love to say, do it across the board, but you can't do that. I mean, you've got to find places. I think mandatory spending, discretionary spending, Congress has the ability to make the laws and how those budgets are written and how the money's spent.
As you well know, in the next 10 years, between Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, defense spending, interest on the debt, and VA, that's 80% of the budget.
Yeah.
So obviously something has to be done. It's very hard. Let me read you. I just want to get your reaction. There's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a center-right think tank, who focuses on budget issues. And he writes, serious lawmakers should offer more modest and plausible saving targets and actually follow through. A Congress that enacts a $400 billion in 10-year spending cut is more fiscally responsible than one that promises to balance the budget within a decade, shuts down the government, brings a public backlash, and ultimately enacts nothing.
Right.
What say you?
We don't want it to be political. I mean, nobody wants us to be political maneuvering. And that's always the risk, especially going into this. Now, up until this juncture, I just found out this morning that the president will sit down with Republicans, will sit down with Speaker McCarthy. That has not been the case up until...
That's a shift in posture, isn't it?
...than just now. And that is a move in the right direction. We've got to be able to work together. If you look at the midterms, this isn't about one side or the other. Our nation really is divided. And our Americans hate Congress right now because of the posturing, because of the politicizing and weaponizing every single issue. Nobody wants to see... I don't want to see the debt limit vote or increase... be weaponized, but we have to have an honest conversation and say what we've been doing, and it's been $5 trillion over the last 2 years so far, $8 trillion under the previous administration. We have to admit that what we've been doing is wrong, and we need to find a way to correct the course in the future, and whatever that looks like. I mean, I'm totally open to other ideas. I want to put forth thoughtful policy. I want to show the art of the possible. We can't continue down this path.
Let me ask you against that backdrop then, and it's, I have to tell you, really refreshing to hear a fresh voice, fresh face in Congress talking about fiscal responsibility. How do you deal with the fact, you know, as a Republican, that while you're correct, it has been Republicans and Democrats on both sides who have contributed to these exorbitant deficits and debts? The hypocrisy on the right is unique because Republicans have pretended to be for fiscal responsibility, and then gone on to, in the example of even Speaker McCarthy. As you know, Speaker Kevin McCarthy voted to suspend the debt ceiling three times when President Trump was president, and voted for spending that was pre-pandemic spending that helped contribute to the debt and the deficits. So how, as a Republican, do you talk about fiscal responsibility and understanding that Republicans are playing footsie with brinksmanship and have their own credibility issues?
Both sides have a credibility issue.
You know, but Republicans were the ones saying they cared about fiscal responsibility.
Well, just last summer, we had the Inflation Reduction Act, which, according to every economist...
No Democrat has pretended to be a fiscal steward of the economy.
Yeah. Well, they all said, hey, this is going to help inflation. Come and find out. It doesn't help inflation, actually. Then we had the infrastructure bill, which didn't do a lot for traditional infrastructure, did a lot for the Green New Deal type of energy policy, but didn't secure the grid, didn't work on traditional roads and bridges. That was only about 3% of the budget. And so I would lay the hypocrisy on both sides. And I've called both sides out on it. I mean, I've been pretty consistent in that. I ran on that. I am still putting that marker out there today because I don't agree with my party on their spending. They've done things that have increased the tax burden on Americans and hardworking Americans. And so I've tried to be consistent in that. And that's why, you know, it's important to have these conversations.
But
it's important to place the blame.
As a Republican, you get a certain amount of pushback from people saying, but Republicans, you know, you can say the Democrats
they're
also.
They're equally responsible. $8 trillion under the previous administration that a lot of people voted for, and now we're having this conversation. And that's why Americans hate Congress, because of the hypocrisy and the lack of consistency, because of who's in power. And then it's politicizing and weaponizing every single issue. So if this is going to be our position, which is great, I'm happy to hear it, but let's let that be our position no matter who is in power. That would be consistent, and that would be in line with the majority of Americans.
Yeah. One more follow-up on Speaker McCarthy. You know, you were pretty vocal about actually criticizing the deals that he made to become Speaker with some of the more extreme members of the conference. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, as we all know, has trafficked in conspiracy theories, and she's frankly made bigoted statements, statements supporting violence. She's a follower of QAnon, forged a close alliance with Speaker McCarthy, who recently, just this week, reportedly said, I will never leave that woman. I will always take care of her. You all have had some choice words for one another, and it is reported that Speaker McCarthy has also tried to prevent you from feuding. What can you say about how this conference is going to work together? And what can you You know, how precarious is Speaker McCarthy's leadership position?
Well, he was the only speaker possible for our conference because of the diversity of opinions, the diversity of political views within our conference. He's the only one that could bring us all together, number one. Number two, I don't take orders from anybody. I didn't when I was at the Citadel. I don't now. And I think that's very important that I keep true to who I am, which is very much trying to have an independent voice and being consistent on the Constitution and on policies that matter to my state and my district. It's not going to be, in no way is it going to be easy. And we just saw, I think it was this morning, where you know our committee assignments came out and some of those holdouts, I mean, they got what they wanted. And there were handshakes. There were promises made. And I don't know that we have all the answers, but some of the most vocal people got some of the most high-profile committee assignments. And I can appreciate having the diversity on all the committees, but when you reward those for that kind of behavior, then what kind of precedent does that set? What does that precedent does that set for the majority makers, people that came in winning by 1 point? When I came into Congress, I flipped a seat that had a Democrat in it. I won by 1 point. And so where are our views represented? And I think it's going to be incumbent upon us, those that have a more independent streak, to be more vocal, which is why, like right now, I'm looking around and it's very lonely right now. Because the reason that we're in the majority are because of people who have more of an independent streak, those that flipped seats. That's the reason that we're here.
Yeah, it's not the Paul Gosars. It's the Nancy Maces.
It's not the safe seats, yeah. Right? Yeah. It's the people that have to pull together all sides. And I'll tell you, looking at my district, independents outnumber Republicans. And there's this lack of acknowledgement that that is the direction that the nation is headed in. And that's why you see me speaking up on so many of these issues. I'm going to be an independent voice. I'm going to speak out even against my own party on both sides when they're being inconsistent or doing things that I believe are inherently wrong with the future direction of our country. Those voices are missing right now.
Are some of those voices going to play out in the Oversight Committee? Because on the Oversight Committee, upon which you sit, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Paul Gosar, now Scott Perry, who refused to comply with the January 6th subpoena, is on the Oversight Committee. Are they going to be serious members?
So last session, and I don't know who the Democrats have on Oversight right now, but you had members of the Squad. Mm-hmm. So there's parity here on, you know, you've got this, you have the Squad on Oversight, and then you have some of your House Freedom Caucus folks. But I will tell you, Jamie Comer is a serious leader. He's the chairman of the Oversight Committee. I will have a gavel on the Oversight Committee as well. And I know that there'll be investigations, as there always is. But also, we want the committee to be taken seriously. I can tell you, one of the last bills that I passed out of Oversight last session was with Ro Khanna. It was a cybersecurity bill, quantum computing bill that the president signed into law. And I want to make sure, I want to ensure that that substantive policy can continue on that committee. And that's where I believe you'll see a mix of that. There'll be some members that are just going to use it to parody themselves and to raise money, just like they did with the speaker vote, and that's just fake, right? That's not genuine. And then you're going to have other members like myself and others that really want to have substantive debate and policy discussions and pass bills that can be signed into law.
The committee has sent several letters to various officials demanding information related to the investigation of classified documents found in Biden's office and his residence. It appears that Biden's team notified the DOJ and the National Archives and Records Administration as soon as the documents were found, promptly returned them, and is cooperating with the investigation. There is a perception that Republicans are treating the Trump documents investigation and the Biden documents investigation as the same thing. But do you see substantive differences?
There are differences. I mean, the president now says they're being transparent and they're complying. But for 2 months, nobody knew about this. So that's not...
Well, the public didn't know, the public DOJ didn't know. And NARA knew.
Yeah, but the public didn't know about this. And this was days before the midterm election. So there are differences in terms of, one, the public didn't know about it. And now we find out this was obviously 5 years. We don't know where all the documents were stored. We don't know who had access to them. I mean, there are slight differences.
It's worth pointing out, though, that while there were 2 months that the Biden administration, of course, wasn't transparent with the American people, there were 9 months that the former President Trump wasn't transparent with the American people. NARA had reached out to him for documents in May of 2021, and 9 months went by before the American public knew about it, and he had even lied to reporters, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, about having documents. So in that sense, do you think it's apples and oranges or apples and apples?
It's even hard because we don't know what's in the documents. Like, how can you compare it? We don't know. None of us know what classified information or top secret. It could be apples to apples. It could be apples to oranges, which is why it's so important for the DOJ and the National Archives, and even if the FBI needs to get involved, to investigate them in the same manner. Now, my understanding with the previous president, that DOJ knew about it, FBI knew about it, National Archives knew about it. They even went to the location. They knew where they were stored. They had access to them, at least at certain times, they had access to that room and certain documents. So we want the investigation to go on, but we know more about the documents at Mar-a-Lago than we know about the Biden documents. And in fact, just a week ago, more documents were found in Delaware. And so I think it is a fair question because we know so little. Now, the other thing, the distinction that I want to make, because so many people want to talk about, well, the intent, like what's that about? That's not what the law says. The actual U.S. Code of Laws is very specific on this. It's knowledge. And that's where, you know, I think obviously the DOJ has its work cut out for them. Now the former vice president also, documents were found this week too. I'm like, how far
Vice
back
President
do we have
Michael
to go?
Pence.
Do we need to go to President Obama and Bush? Like, how far back does this
and
go?
Clinton.
I know that when I go into a SCIF and I'm looking at classified material, I just did this yesterday, that those documents remain in the SCIF. You are not allowed to take those documents with you because of the classified nature and the sensitive material within them. And so from a process and protocol standpoint, I'm sort of looking around like other members of Congress thinking to myself, how did this happen?
Do you think they all do
it? Well, apparently it looks like they did. I mean, and, you know, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard. If Americans are held accountable for the crimes that they commit, right, everybody should be held to the same, what is the standard, and treat everybody the same way, whether you are at the top of the ticket president or you're, you know, a hardworking American. Everybody should be treated the same under the law. And that's, you know,
so
time will tell if that's the case.
Well, can you affirm that you're committed to applying an equal scrutiny to Biden and Trump
100%,
on this issue?
100%.
So then why is the Oversight Committee only investigating Biden?
Because we don't have as much information about those documents. A lot more is known about the documents at Mar-a-Lago, the access to them, who had access, that there was an investigation going on for 2 years, and that they were working, their attorneys were going back and forth until there was a stalemate, apparently, this last summer. But we don't know as much about the Biden documents. And there are even some Democrats that are speaking out about this. We saw comments from Progressive Ro Khanna, for example, this week, holding the administration, the current president, to account. And that is refreshing.
Does it influence your thinking that Senator Lindsey Graham from your home state said he's known Joe Biden for a long time and he doubts that there's anything sinister here?
Again, the law doesn't matter if there's intent or if it's sinister. The law only matters about whether or not you knew that you had the documents in your possession.
Representative, you've been very outspoken about a new member of your conference, Representative George Santos, who
should resign. Let's be clear.
You've been outspoken that
he should resign.
Yeah. Instead of resigning, he's actually been assigned to committees this week. What do you think of that?
I would want to make sure he's not assigned to any committee that puts him in hands of classified information or top secret information or inside of a SCIF. This is clearly someone who should resign but won't. Clearly, he is enjoying the limelight and the spotlight. But it's very obvious that we have a problem within our conference. And if we're going to throw people off of certain committees because of things that they've said or things that they've done, then if we're going to do it to the left, then certainly we should hold ourselves to the same standard. Whatever that standard is, treat everybody the same way. And so that's why I've been very adamant about this, because this is wrong. This is someone who's clearly got issues. And, you know, he wants to say, hey, I was elected by the voters. The voters, they didn't have a fair shot at it because they were lied to. At literally everything the guy has said turns out is a complete lie. It boggles my mind that folks are giving this guy a pass and giving him excuses. Like, I know we have a narrow majority, but is it really worth it to give this guy a pass? When people don't trust Congress, and there's a reason for it, because when each side is in power, well, you know, they get treated special. And that's not the way it should be. Everybody should be treated the same regardless of their party. And this guy, he's got to go.
This program aired for 33 years and was hosted by William F. Buckley Jr. In 1973, William F. Buckley Jr. hosted an episode of this program where he answered questions from journalists and writers. Mary Nichols Perot, an editor of The Village Voice, brought up the subject of marijuana. Take a look at this.
I have a frivolous question for you. It's a matter of logistics. A couple of years ago, you testified in behalf of Congressman Ed Koch's marijuana commission bill. And you said that you had gone on your boat outside the 3-mile limit and you had smoked some pot. What I want to know is, I suppose you said that you went outside the 3-mile limit. Perhaps it was a polite fiction so that you could appear to be law and order, or perhaps not. How did you get the pot on your boat?
I grew it.
On the boat?
Yeah.
Well, but you had to come within the 3-mile limit in possession of the pot, did you not?
No. I consumed it all.
How did you get the seeds to the
boat? Oh, you stayed out there, out beyond 3 miles?
That's right.
You grew the pot while you were out there.
That's right.
I see. How long does it take to grow a pot?
Depends how much time you've got.
Okay.
That's hilarious.
In 1973, when that clip aired, William F. Buckley Jr. supported the decriminalization of marijuana. You've been very outspoken about your views about marijuana decriminalization, legalization. It even became, frankly, a point of vulnerability in your primary. Make the conservative case for decriminalization.
Yeah, they even ran ads against me. Well, it is wildly popular, even in conservative South Carolina. I would encourage all of my conservative colleagues to poll the issue in their districts and their states, and they will be overwhelmingly surprised. And I put forth a bill last session called the States Reform Act, and the conservative argument is to allow states to have the right to make their own laws on cannabis. And that's what the bill does. It provides a regulatory framework at the federal level, super low federal excise tax, because we know that the higher the taxes are, the greater, the more illicit markets there are in that state. So you want to reduce the proclivity for that. But this has been a very long, very expensive, very painful, very harmful war on a plant. And I look at my own life and my own life experiences. When I was raped at the age of 16, I was in a really, really vulnerable position from a mental health perspective and getting through that. And I started self-medicating at the time, not realizing it because I was young, with cannabis. It caught my anxiety. I could sleep at night. I laughed. I told jokes. I thought I was funny. And I survived. And when you talk to people, whether it's a veteran who's got PTSD, someone with Parkinson's or a terminal illness, someone with epilepsy, and you see the miracles that marijuana can bring to the lives of people, you have to ask yourself, where is the compassion? Why would we deprive people from something that is not harmful? It is not a gateway drug. It is something that can save lives.
I've heard you say it saved your life.
Yeah, it saved my life. And, you know, I'm older now. I can look back on why I did what I did and some of the decisions that I made. I didn't know at the time I was self-medicating because I was just too close and it was too traumatic for the experience. But when I look back at it now, it's very, very clear to me as an adult, as a mother of 2 teenage kids, that it changed my life in a way where I could move forward. I then went on, I did it for about a year, and I went on to the Citadel. I graduated in 3 years, the top of my class, as the first woman to do so. I worked in the corporate space for a while. I started my own company in 2008. I added on commercial real estate. Now I'm in Congress. Like, I made it. And I've seen what it's done to people's lives and how miraculous it can be. And I don't know why any conservative or anyone would want to deprive another human from that opportunity. And that's the case that I've made is it can be conservative, it can be bipartisan. When you allow people, you allow states to be in their driver's seat on this issue and make their own laws either to have it or prohibit it, I mean, it's wildly popular with conservatives, even across the state of South Carolina. It's a no-brainer.
What do you say to the conservatives who disagree with you?
Well, the data is there. You can look at the Journal of American Medicine. There's study after study. We need more studies, I would argue, as well. But it's not mental health issues are a gateway drug to heavier drugs. Mm-hmm. Prescription opioids, prescription painkillers, being prescribed heroin for your pain is a gateway drug. And you talk to police officers, they're not arresting people that are, you know, that are on marijuana or on cannabis for violent crimes. It just is not a thing. And so, you know, looking at the real causes here, that's where we have to be, as opposed to playing to a very small, narrow, single-digit margin of your base in a primary. And we're talking about a very small group of folks that believe it's a gateway drug. The vast majority of people just aren't there. And a lot has changed over the last 80 years. And so even talking to my parents, they've changed. They're in their 80s now, but they are much more open to it. And then when you poll it and you see how popular it is, but federalism is inherent to our nation. And that's why I sponsored a bill, drafted a bill, giving states the right to determine their own cannabis laws. It's just common sense.
This is a Southern states' rights we can get behind.
Yeah.
You represent a coastal city. Mm-hmm. There are a significant number of Republican lawmakers who won't acknowledge that climate change is real, that humans contribute to it, let alone work in Congress on policy solutions that will be productive. What's a conservative argument and the conservative case for climate action?
Well, for example, you just mentioned it. My district, it's almost the industry, is predicated on a clean environment, clean air, clean water, clean beaches. Tourism and hospitality is a major economic driver for South Carolina, and my district especially. So if we don't have those things, then we don't have an economy in the Lowcountry and in South Carolina. And so I talk about the free market. Well, the market drives that. If you don't have all those things, you don't have beach renourishment projects, clean air, clean water, clean environment, great food and culture, then you're not going to have that industry. And it's looking at, you know, it's looking at two industry. Industry is working with them to have realistic goals, you know. And when we did, for example, when Russia invaded Ukraine, for example, Rokana and I did a bill to ban Russia's imports of dirty oil and gas in this country. But our bill was unique because we were looking at alternative forms of energy. What else is out there? So until our natural gas runs out, I think that's an opportunity there. But we should be working on cleaner forms of energy. And I will tell you, as a Republican who works on environmental issues, I get called out by the left as being a climate denier. That doesn't do anybody any good either, because that makes Republicans probably more afraid to work on this issue if they're going to be attacked for it. But I'm in a swing district, in a purple district. It is a very important issue. Now that we're in a slim majority, I have a stronger voice, as do other Republicans like myself. So when we are doing energy policy, for example, we're doing another oil reserve bill this week, and I was asked, where do I stand on it? Well, I said my response was, well, where is the bill on looking at drilling off the coast of South Carolina? Because if that's included in the bill, you're not going to get my support, because that's not something my state supports. So because we have a slimmer majority, voices like ours have greater strength, and we need to use that strength when it's important to our communities and our states.
You've referenced a couple times that you're sort of feels as a moderate Republican. I don't want to, you know, use the word moderate has always been a dirty word in Republican circles, but
I wouldn't consider myself a moderate.
You're a conservative Republican, but you're on an island alone on some of these issues, and you're willing to speak up. What are your best hopes for bipartisanship this Congress? In terms of legislation, actual stuff that you'll work on that you think might really become law.
My policy has always been, if you're willing to work with me, I am willing to work with you. I don't care if you have an R or a D by your name. And when I was a freshman, we passed over 20 bills out of committee working across the aisle. We did at least 10 to 12 out of the floor of the House, one of which was signed into law by the President of the United States. And that's not going to change. And what I want to show is a body of work that can be nonpartisan. Myself, as a fiscal conservative, as a constitutional conservative who tends to be socially moderate, socially tolerant, whatever you want to call it, normal, small L, libertarian-ish, that's where I think the majority of Americans are. But I want to show my body of work. I want to continue that work and show people this doesn't have to be as hard as you're making it. And all this fighting, I mean, there's so much that we can agree on.
Well, you voted for the Respect for Marriage Act.
Yeah.
For example.
You know, shouldn't be controversial at all.
What's this session's Respect for Marriage Act?
Right. Well, they would have to make...
In the context of a bipartisan, you know, real bipartisan.
Well, ensuring there are always religious liberties in place and protections. I mean, you know, under the bill that we voted on most recently, a church is protected. And so anyone that argued that it wasn't telling you the truth. I mean, a church can decide, hey, we don't want to marry sinners. Okay, you don't have to marry sinners.
I mean, the Respect for Marriage Act codified the First Amendment and protections for religious freedom into the bill itself. So it was a great example, I think, of bipartisan compromise.
Yeah, and biracial marriage. Like, wait, why would we deny that right to other human beings? But again, that's why I scratched my head. I was one of only 8 Republicans to vote to protect women's access to FDA-approved birth control and contraception measures. It just, you know, but you'll see in the 118th Congress, I will be putting forth an abundance of legislation that shows as a fiscal conservative the opportunity and the ability to reach across the aisle. That is what we're going to be doing. And if it can't pass muster in the Senate, then why are we doing it?
Can you give me one or two examples of issues that you'll work on?
Well, I mean, I'm working on a body of bills right now regarding women, women's issues, women's health, post-Roe era. What does that look like? That's an area. The environment would be another area where we've got to find some middle ground. It's an important issue, especially to young Republican and Democrat voters. They care about these issues. I'm on a coastal district. That's another one. But cybersecurity is another area that we are focusing on because I will be chairman of the Cybersecurity Tech and Innovation Subcommittee on Oversight. Cyber is the new frontier, the new battlefront. That is where wars are now being fought and will continue to be fought in the future. We're seeing that in the case of Russia invading Ukraine. But those are a handful of places where we want to show here's opportunity for us to work together, and there's no downside to it. Cannabis is another area that I've been working on. I'll do my state's Reform Act, but I'm also looking at smaller pieces of legislation that might be easier pills to swallow for some groups of the Republican Party and trying to make it more amenable. But you'll see us work on an enormous body of legislation that will showcase those opportunities.
You have an open invitation to come back here and talk about any of them anytime.
Thank you.
Quick, I have a final one for you. You know, President Trump is not going quietly into the night. He's running for president again. And he is coming to South Carolina, your state, this weekend to launch a new round of publicity around his presidential campaign. Are you going to attend the event?
I am not going to attend the event. I'm keeping my powder dry until the field is set. I want to see a vigorous primary, and I want to host candidate forums. We're going to call it Cocktails with the Candidates. We're going to do a series in the Lowcountry with any of the presidential candidates that would like to have an audience with our constituents and our voters. We're going to hold those forums. I want to hear from everybody, and I want to see some diversity on the ticket.
Two candidates who represent diversity for the Republican Party are also from South Carolina. So I find it curious that President Trump is coming to South Carolina. Of course, former Governor Nikki Haley and Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley and Senator Tim Scott, are both considering, it is reported, a run for the GOP nomination, both from South Carolina. Why is President Trump coming to South Carolina?
They're both from my district, actually. So I sit behind Tim in church, and Nikki lives in the district, too. They both live in the district. I'm close with both of them. And what, to me, as a Republican, is so exciting is the leadership that's coming out of the state of South Carolina. To have two people from South Carolina, both in my district, be potential folks that are running for president in 2024— That is enormously exciting for our state. Our state is also first in the South in the Republican primary series. It's first ever for the Democrats. It'll now be the first state in the Democrat primaries. But there's so much opportunity in South Carolina coming out of the state. It's really an exciting time to be a Republican.
So why is President Trump coming to South Carolina?
Well, it's first in the South. I mean, once you get through Iowa and New Hampshire, it's South Carolina. And historically, with the exception, with only one or two exceptions over the last few decades, if you win South Carolina, on average, the Republican that wins South Carolina goes on to become the nominee. That is the precedent. That's how important our state is going to be in the 2024 primary.
Is it time for the party to move on from Donald Trump?
It's time for the party overall to look forward and not backward.
It's not the same thing.
And if you look at the midterm elections, certain folks that were nominated in the primary process could not win the general election. If you pigeonhole yourself into one corner of our party and are not open in talking to independent voters, or those who are left of center, right of center, if you're not appealing to those people, if you're only appealing to a fragment of the Republican Party, you will not win. And that was just proven in the midterm elections.
You were on the ballot against Donald Trump, essentially. I mean, Donald Trump endorsed a primary opponent against you.
I was one of the only Republicans in the House to beat,
to survive Trump coming after
the primary. And there was money invested in that. But the policies, there were great policies in his administration. Everything from criminal justice and prison reform, from the First Step Act, lower taxes, something that I supported. There was low unemployment for women, African Americans, black and brown communities. There was great things happening. Policies are one thing, but the politics of personal destruction when you're all on the same team is not something that I've been able to support. And I'm a very independent voice.
How about the destruction of the Constitution? I'm looking at January 6th and the legacy that Trump left behind that day.
I was very vocal on that day as well, and which is why I got primaried in the first place.
Yeah.
But again, the voters in South Carolina, we tend to march to the beat of our own drum. And I have worked so hard for my constituents. I don't care if you have an R or a D by your name or if you're an independent. If you come to us for help, we're going to help you. That is my job. That is literally what I'm supposed to be doing. And I've been a very independent voice. I promised I wouldn't toe the party line. I've proven that over and over and over again. And that independent streak is what is driving our success. We just won re-election by 14 points. And the primary we won by 9 points. And so I think that we're on to something.
Yeah. Well,
but that's not by design.
Can I put a pin in it, though? I mean, mm-hmm. You won re-election by that much against a Trump-endorsed primary opponent that mm-hmm. you survived and then went on to win. And the first vote you took in Congress was to vote to certify the election for Joe Biden, which is what caught Donald Trump's ire in the first place. So you could say you're onto something, but it also feels like what you're onto is that the party needs to move on from Donald Trump.
At least
you've experienced that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to look forward, not backward. Relitigating elections where fraud was not discovered. Like, I even look at my own election in 2020. We had 14,000 absentee ballots that were misprinted. Both sides had attorneys overseeing the process of reprinting the ballots and making sure everything was kosher and done correctly and by law. That's the way the system should be. And relitigating all of these things isn't where we should be. We need to be looking forward. I still want to get the majority in 2 years. I want to win the White House in 2 years. But if you ignore the growing masses of independent voters, and I'm seeing it, this district has changed so much over the last decade, you know, part of it's political instinct, and two, but it's listening to the voters and listening to my constituents, and they don't want someone who's going to be like everybody else. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for someone who's going to be more independent-minded, be fiscally conservative, socially moderate. I mean, I think that's the direction that the nation is headed in. So folks that are playing to the fringes right now, both on the right and the left, that's not the future that our nation is headed in. And seeing what happened in the general election, how we flipped 40% of Democrat precincts in parts of the district, and then we outperformed the former president in the most conservative parts of the district. And if we don't pay attention to what actually happened in the midterm election, and we do what we've always done, we're going to lose. And we're on the trajectory for that right now. Very early into this session, we are not listening to the folks who got us here.
How much power do you think Trump still has with the base of the party?
Well, I think he's got significant influence in the party still. There's always going to be a percentage of Republican primary voters who support him. I think there are more people that support his policies, which is why you're seeing a movement to encourage Ron DeSantis to run. People see him as someone who can take the torch from the former president and move it forward without some of the other baggage that's there that would preclude independent voters, for example, from getting on board. If we have a nominee that can't give independent voters a home in 2024, we are being enormously short-sighted, and we will not win. Any models, data modeling that have this, that don't include some of the more independent-minded folks is going to be very short-sighted in 2024. And I see it every day in my district, in the town halls, in the surveys, the polling that we do. Not everybody's on board with where both sides are headed to the fringes.
Nancy Mace, thank you for coming to Firing Line. Thank you for your candor and for joining me.
Thank you.